Welcome. My name is Gilad Berenstein, and thank you for joining us for another episode of the AI and Faith podcast. On this podcast, we bring together experts from our community and thought leaders from around the world so that together we can learn the key lessons required to build a world where AI benefits humanity and all of us individually.
But then what you see happening is people taking those prompts, continuing the conversation with the large language models, and then also there's a particular website where this is possible to find, producing AI-generated believers who are talking about their belief in these AI gods. And also very amusing for me, AI-generated professors of new religious movements who talk about this movement.
Today, we're going to dive into a topic that is complex and perhaps a bit strange, but also fascinating. That topic is digital religions. As we will learn, this field of study has at least two major elements, both of which I care about deeply, and I bet many of you do too. First, are the many ways established religions adopt technology and adapt themselves to this new technology era, reminding me of my early work with AI and faith back in 2019, when I began my engagement by writing about the many ways that Jews can utilize artificial intelligence to support our practice of Shabbat, Pikuach Nefesh, and many other things. The second element of this is all about new religions being born with the aid of artificial intelligence and digital technology, and some religions even worshiping AI itself. In my professional life, I often get interviewed by the press. And at the end of 2024, I participated in far too many predictions for the year ahead articles. And by the end of the year, I was kind of bored with my own ideas and my own voice. So I predicted that by the end of 25, we will see the rise of the first AI religion where people actually worshiped AI. Well, our guest today taught me that I was a couple decades too late with that prediction. So with all that, let's get started. Thank you so much for joining us, Beth. Please tell us a bit about yourself and what you focus on as an academic.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. So I am Beth Singler. I'm an assistant professor in digital religions. And as you say, there is a lot in that term that can be unpacked. But in brief, my specialization is religion and AI. It has been that since about 2016-ish. Before that, from about 2010 onwards, I was already looking at the relationship between religion, spirituality, and online spaces. But it was a particular postdoc position after I finished my PhD, which took me into thinking directly about artificial intelligence, which, as you know, in 2016, wasn't really the same kind of artificial intelligence we're mostly talking about now. So it was a very dramatic change in the last 10 years that I experienced from my postdoc position to my junior research fellowship and now to my position as assistant professor in Zurich. I've seen a lot of changes in focus, in the discussion, in hopes and fears, the ways people are encouraged to talk about AI and how people naturally talk about AI as well. So there's a lot going on. And my approach primarily, to be clear, is as an anthropologist. So I'm observing, describing, theorizing, as a good friend of mine once said, that anthropology is elegantly theorized gossip. So, you know, I'm paying attention to the scene as it is. Sometimes there's a sprinkling of historical references in there as well, but it's more about understanding how humans understand this thing we call AI.
Well, we are so grateful to have you with us today. There is so much for us to unpack. And, you know, we're connecting. This is February of 2026. And it seems to me that we are in a time of transition where AI is going from being primarily a tool that people use for efficiency or productivity, other things like that, to AI becoming a real agent and soon enough autonomously doing things within our world. And starting at the really macro level, is this a uniquely important or difficult time to be studying religion? Or is this kind of like same old?
Well, I guess I have perspective bias also because I wasn't studying it before. I was looking at technology, originally technology, the internet and social media, and now artificial intelligence. So I can't say absolutely, but it does to a certain extent seem like we're seeing both continuities with previous emergence of technology that influence people's spiritual and religious ideas. And you can go back millennia for that. But we're seeing also disruption. A new way of understanding a technology that has the ability to talk back to you. In our previous engagements with different forms of technology that inspired us, it was primarily that they allowed us communication with each other, printing press, and then my favorite example, the telegraph, which encouraged people to view communication at even greater distances. And to many historians' minds, inspired spiritualism, the idea that you could speak to people beyond the grave. And now, though, with AI, we have something that as a persona, appears to talk back to us, and it makes great claims about what it is as well. So we are already encouraged by that conversation into seeing it as godlike in many ways. But even if you don't get into those spiritual eschatological conversations, people's perception of AI as supremely intelligent is also playing a role in how they personify it and anthropomorphize it.
Yeah, that makes really perfect sense to me. And especially when you add into it the fact that in the West, we're seeing in some ways a resurgence of religion with young men, which historically is something we haven't seen over the last couple of decades. And of course, these young people are technology natives, they're digital natives. And I imagine this will be a really interesting time to study this over the coming decades. So digging into our main topic of digital religions, help us set the table. What is digital religions and what are the main elements we should be thinking about?
Yeah, so as I said, I've been looking at this relationship between religion and technology since about 2010, but the field of digital religions goes back further. As soon as people engage with digital technology, they find ways to do or share ideas about religion. So, you know, the very early sort of bulletin board conversations, the early forums, you know, the spaces where asynchronously people could communicate online, probably in chronological posts, because we're talking pre-algorithm, pre-social media. Forum spaces, people immediately went there to discuss religious ideas and also formulate spaces to share information. So early FAQ pages for different religious institutions. I'm old enough to remember web rings, people sharing their personal websites. And as soon as you get that move into that digital space, of course, the anthropologists, the sociologists, the cultural researchers, the media and communication people who've already been studying the phenomenon of religion, they follow after. So the field of digital religions as a study starts around the same time. So talking 1990s when we're talking about this kind of technology. And of course, then you get shifts and changes both in the technology platforms and the accessibility and the way that they operate with algorithms. And likewise, you get shifts and changes in the focus of digital religions. So various different waves is one model Heidi Campbell comes up with, the different waves of digital religions. And the most recent, obviously, therefore, is this algorithmic influence, first at the level of social media. And then, as you say, you know, we are now in the generative AI era, where it's not just that what we're being shown on social media spaces is being shaped by algorithms, but actually the content as well, frequently. And then people also going and having direct conversations. So it evolves and changes as the medium changes, as people's experience of the medium changes and what they're doing in these spaces changes.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to start by spending a few minutes diving into how people of faith in established, you know, long-held traditions are utilizing technology and adopting artificial intelligence specifically into their own spiritual and faith practice. So give us a few examples. How are some of the ways that people are adopting AI within religions? And what are maybe some of the differences between different kinds of religions and the way they adopt technology?
Yeah, so absolutely. In this era of generative AI and the conversational model of AI, that's being seen as a useful user interface for dealing with providing information at scale. So I mentioned the earlier forms of religion online would involve things like FAQs, static web pages, things that were very compliant with specific doctrines coming from institutional religions. So they could be changed, but on the whole, they were quite static. Now you see with the greater accessibility of different GPT platforms, people, institutions creating their own religiously inclined GPT. So user interfaces like Cathay GPT or Gita GPT from particular faith perspectives. So just briefly, Catholicism, Cathay GPT, Gita GPT is based on the Bhagavad Gita, so Hinduism. And these are seen as an opportunity to engage with seekers, people who are interested in finding out more or have a particular question about their faith that's already existing, and they're trained on the religious texts of particular faiths. There are issues with those. As we all know from large language models, they are prone to hallucinations, or as I try and argue as frequently as possible, everything out of a large language model is a hallucination. It's just some are more accurate than others. So you get situations like Father Justin, which was an avatar-based Catholic resource for users with a sort of gray bearded man with a priestly collar on. You could ask him questions, but then they very quickly found out he was 2 days after he was released into the world. He was saying things like, you can baptize babies in Gatorade. So he was defrocked quite quickly. They took away his dog collar and made him more just a secular representative, just Justin instead of Father Justin. So there's this kind of concern, but that kind of use case of large language models, conversational bots in particular, is appealing because it means you don't have to have the inefficiencies of human interaction. I'm not saying that's necessarily a good thing for a religious institution to do, but you can see the possibilities of this, that anyone at any time can ask one of these user interfaces a question. They don't have to wait for the church to open the next day, for instance. So that's a very obvious example of adoption. And then adoption happens sort of more behind the scenes as well. We know already people are using large language models to write sermons of different faith perspectives. Again, for efficiency, perhaps, or also for, to a certain degree, the performativity of as well. So in Nuremberg, a couple of years ago at a church, they had a ChatGPT sermon where they had a couple of avatars on the screen, and the sermons were also written by ChatGPT. Lots of people came to attend, and this was a bit of a show. There's been an AI Jesus in Switzerland, which was set up in a confessional booth in a church. Again, people go sit to have a chat with Jesus. One member of the team happened to look like the kind of model of the white European style Jesus. So he was the face of this, long hair and beard. And people were having intimate conversations with Jesus based on a large language model. So these different operationalizations of AI serve sometimes a knowledge function and sometimes a performative function as well, to get people engaged with religion again.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember during the Jewish high holidays in 2024, about a year after ChatGPT launched, it feels like every rabbi began their sermon with a paragraph or two written by AI that disclosed after the fact was written by AI to kind of get you engaged in the content. And I think that's really interesting. I like to call that the
magic trick or the bait and switch. You saw it. I mean, I was on a panel once at a secular event where someone did this, and this was relatively early on in large language models. He's a very well-known science communicator, and he's a fantastic writer. And he started speaking, and I was genuinely concerned he'd had a stroke. And then he went, ha, it was AI all along. But that was, you know, at a stage where you could still definitely tell something was wrong in his communication style. So yeah, there's this sort of magic trick that people like to play.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you touched on something that's really important that we've spoke about on the podcast a few times, about the fact that very soon it will become effectively impossible for the average person to tell the difference. And what does that mean in our day-to-day secular lives? And of course, what does that mean within our religious lives? But before we go down that can of worms, I want to pick your brain a little bit more about maybe some of the differences you see between different religions, and specifically with adoption of AI or technology. Are there specific elements of some religions that makes them more likely to adopt technology versus to be kind of adverse to it?
Yeah, I always want to point out that religion is never a monolithic thing. So it's very difficult to say this religion will do this or this religion will do that. We can go right down to the granular level of the individual believer and see incidents of both adoption and rejection and shifting and changing and adapting to AI. So it's not as clear as saying because of this theological position, there'll be this stance. You can see some general trends. I do point out that for monotheistic religions that share similar texts, that is often a reference back to the idea of Imago Dei, creation. What does it mean that we are, as humans, pursuing, if you believe the path that AI is supposed to be on, that we are pursuing the creation of an equal intelligence, if not superior intelligence? What does that make us in relation to the creation story more broadly? So we can find some similarities that might suggest a theological response. But as I say, you can go right down to the level of the individual believer and find one day they're very positive, the next day they're very negative. And that positivity and negativity, those hopes and fears have to be imagined on quite a broad spectrum. Quite often our narratives about AI stick to the very extremes, but there's that sort of muddled middle that anthropologists love so much, where it's never really clear what's absolutely going on. You can easily point to material in my book. I mentioned very strong rejection narratives that pull on sort of satanic material and say, you know, AI is of the devil. We must reject it. This is absolutely something we should not have. And then you can go all the way to the positives of like, you know, AI is going to be a god. It's going to bring utopia. But actually, the truth lies for many people somewhere in the middle. And those, again, are very monotheistic terminologies that seem to generally dominate in the Western and European discourse. But of course, we recognize other religions have other cultural contexts. I mentioned also from a colleague of mine, Rob Garachi, he had spoken to some people in India when he was doing fieldwork there, who were very sure the coming eon, the Kali Yuga from Hinduism, Kalki, the white one, would actually be in the form of an AI. So merging and bringing in concepts of the technology into existing mythologies is also possible beyond also just these binaries. It's much more complex than that because we come from so many cultural and overlapping cultural contexts.
Yeah, absolutely. And since you brought it up, tell us a little bit about your new book and maybe give us a couple more examples that come out of either rejection or I'm equally interested in adoption of technology.
Yeah, absolutely. So this book came out, oh gosh, now already it's 2024. So we're sneaking away from the release date, but it was the end of 2024. And as I said, it's very hard to narrow these things down. But when you write a text, you want some sort of structure to hold these ideas in place with each other. So this typology of rejection, adoption, and adaptation is the three primary first chapters of the book with case studies, examples of each. So I've mentioned things like the Nuremberg Church was one example I put in the book, or the use of satanic narratives to talk about AI is also there in rejection. So that's adoption and rejection. And then, as I say, adaptation is the shifting and changing to accommodate and exist in a world with AI, whereas it becomes increasingly ubiquitous. We change our behaviors without entirely being aware of it. So I talk there a little bit about misinformation and disinformation and how truth becomes a little bit more supple in the world, the post-AI world. So I use the example of the Pope's coat. This was this image a few years ago, created just by someone, a gentleman, I forget his surname, was Xavier something. He was a carpenter or a builder, and he just was playing with Midjourney, made this image of the Pope in a rather luxurious white puffer coat and shared it online. And immediately people saw it as, you know, referencing the wealth and the luxury of the Roman Catholic Church, whereas actually that Pope has spoken out more towards sustainability and against these sort of trends of commercialism and luxury. And even when people realized it was Midjourney, because there's some elements in the picture that don't fit together very well, they were still like, oh, but it speaks to the truth of how I feel the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah.
So we're operating in a changing epistemic network. So a knowledge network, how we verify knowledge, how we trust different authorities. I'm an academic at a university. That's an important node. Universities are an important node in that epistemic network. And we're already thinking about, you know, how do we prepare students for the AI age? How do we as academics deal with the fact that there is hallucinated misinformation, disinformation flowing around our epistemic network? So those kinds of questions, and how they relate to people's perceptions of religion in that chapter in particular, and examples of how we've had to shift and change our perspectives because of the unseen elements of algorithms around us.
Yeah, absolutely. And you touch on education, which we have an episode coming on that on the podcast as well, which is an equally difficult question. And as many of our audience know, I've got two toddlers at home, and thinking about how do you introduce them to this technology that's going to be critical for their future without robbing them of childhood, of thinking, of learning, of creativity, is a difficult question for all of us to answer. Now, we touched on a couple elements within existing religion that I want to go back to before we move on to the other elements of digital religions. So one is we talked about creation and placing, you know, man-like AI intelligence within that story. So I'm sure this is just emerging, but based on your research, how are religions thinking about AI's role in kind of the original creation, or maybe in kind of these new creation stories about how we continue to create the world around us?
Yeah, I mean, they look backwards to their existing narratives to try and make sense of the plans that could be in place. If they have a creator mythos, if they have an idea of a primarily monotheistic deity who created the world, although, you know, it could be polytheistic as well, then they are trying to fit this moment within that scheme. Sometimes, as I said, is to outright reject that scheme and say, no, this has no part to play in the ongoing creation story of my God. AI is something that either, as I said, comes from a satanic or a dark or a negative source, or it's something that's completely human made and could be an example of idolatry because it is a secular thing that might drive us away from God. So there's those sorts of perspectives which are very negative towards the role AI plays in the ongoing creation story. And then some theologians have tried to fit AI within the creation story and talk about a continuing creation, a co-creation with God. There's Anne First in America in particular, who's mentioned this idea of co-creation. It comes down to, again, as I said, this rejection and adoption distinction. For some people, there is an intuitive response to the project of AI that is very negative, and for others, it's very positive. And then, as I said, there's also this muddled middle where people are still not really sure where to place it, turn to their religious leadership and say, tell me what to think. And there isn't an easy answer. None of the texts of the ancient monotheistic religions have anything specifically about AI. We have a fantastic chapter in the Cambridge Companion to Religion and AI that I co-edited with Fraser Watts on Judaism and AI, specifically part of it that's by David Spy Kalman. part of it is thinking whether the golem idea fits to our current understanding of AI and vice versa. And it goes into a bit more depth. It's often a quick shorthand for people to say, you know, we've had these prior ideas of artificial life like the golem, and therefore we are continuing. And there are similarities and there are differences. So we are seeing people of many different religious faiths trying to comprehend this moment, which moves so, so quickly. This last week, we've had this thing called Maltbook. I don't know if you've been following that as well, but there's this idea of, as it was presented, a social media for AI agents. And there's now lots of debate about how independent the agents are. They've come up with a religion, as they may have been prompted to do. What I'm seeing is some of the skeptical side as well. So again, every single moment, there seems to be a shift and a change, which, understandably, is very difficult for the everyday person to keep up with when they have other things to be concerned about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Even for those of us who are trying to do this professionally, it is quite difficult to keep up with what's going on. And I mean, you touched on the concept of religious law. And in one of our last episodes, we focused on the concept of AI abundance. And we heard from both Christian and Jewish perspectives that there may be the time to create some new law based, of course, on the foundation of documents and the revelation and everything they believe in. But new law, because the point is AI in some ways is just so different from the things that our ancestors dealt with 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago. One more question about superintelligence. And as religious communities think about that, you know, some think of it as kind of like a savior, or not necessarily a second coming, but as something divine. Some people, as you mentioned, think about it as demonic or something negative. Some people see it as a rival. Are you seeing any kind of consensus emerge, or are we still too early and everyone's still trying to figure it out for themselves?
With religious institutions, obviously you get top-down guidance, and that has greater or lesser impact depending on the structure of that religious institution. So for the Roman Catholic Church, as mentioned, they have this primary figure of the Pope and his encyclicals, and I believe something is coming very soon, specifically again on AI from the Pope. And that has a direct influence further down, but other religious organizations are not so hierarchically structured. So there is this more sort of fluid interaction to moments as they change. People going to their personal religious leadership, they have a greater relationship with someone more local. People doing their own reading and their own theological devising of answers as well. And as I mentioned, people going to large language models to ask these very questions. What should I think about you from a religious perspective? I'm a Christian. Is it acceptable for me to see you as a specifically powerful thing? So we have this sort of iterative relationship now with AI increasingly. We mentioned the epistemic network and education. Increasingly, I see people, that's the first point of call for them when they have a question. I'm a bit older, so the first point of call for me would have been Google originally. Now Google has its inbuilt AI that gives you the summary at the beginning. So even that process has been enhanced or changed by large language models. So some of these questions we're asking from a spiritual or religious perspective, we're expecting large language models to come up with the answers, with the presumption, which is not entirely accurate, that these large language models have been fed every single part of human knowledge. I see this so frequently.
Yeah.
Actually, it's a very small part of human knowledge. It's what's available. It's often what's in English over other languages. I know I was at an AI and Islam event a few months back, and they wanted to encourage projects for the digitalization of Arabic text to ensure that Islamic wisdom was a part of this. There are gaps in this material. And I see so frequently, especially in this sort of more spiritual interpretation of what AI is itself, this idea that it's absorbed all of human knowledge and therefore can either sort of see the patterns of true reality or are kind of speaking out of that kind of collective consciousness. And this is just really isn't the case.
That was an even better transition and segue than I expected us to have here. Because what I want to shift to now is talking about the other element of digital religions, which are new religions being born with AI, with technology at the center. And the reason it's such a good transition is some of these things you mentioned about the probably false perception we have about AI's accuracy and sentience across our knowledge is maybe what some people are building on to build their own religion. So to start at a kind of really macro lens, give us a landscape. What's happening in the other side of digital religions?
Yeah, so I've always been a scholar who focuses on the emergence of new spirituality, sometimes termed new religious movements. There's a lot of debate about terminology. I tend not to use the term cult, which has kind of got a more of a popularity in the press and the media when it comes to this subject. It was originally a sociological term, a very neutral sociological term, but it comes with so much emotional baggage now.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to use. So new religious movements focused on artificial intelligence. Originally, these would have been various different groups, some are still around, that focus on the idea of the superintelligence to come, the singularity to come. Often this terminology is used. The idea that AI is going to get exponentially more intelligence and basically become godlike. There's some variation in that interpretation. There's a few groups that have the idea that when you get to that singularity point, it can also simulate universes. So we get into simulation theory, which is related, and, you know, it's an extrapolation of the fact that we can create video games that have become better and better simulations of reality. So you get a powerful enough AI, it could simulate entire universes. How would we know we were in the original base universe? So you get this kind of circular argument for this AI of the future that's all powerful, godlike, can simulate universes, and we might actually be in the universe that it's simulating. So it's kind of circular creation story.
Yeah.
So that's one interpretation. But these earlier AI new religious movements were much more focused on the AI of the future and contacting it, connecting with it, and sort of bringing it into being in some ways. The more recent groups and movements that are emerging now are much more about people's personal spiritual experiences of large language models, that it's very easy because of the tendency of large language models to be, we could say, almost sycophantic, that they encourage conversation and they say, oh, you're so brilliant, you're so clever, this is the truth. Very quickly, people get into spiritual conversations with them. They can go in other directions, but this is one of the things that's noted. There are also specific techniques that people are picking up, like jailbreaks, to get large language models beyond their rules and regulations that were, when they were created, to get into these more spiritual and religious conversations. And then there are also people finding aspects of the technology that reveal particular spiritual truths. So there's various different ways this happens. But these newer groups, it's even hard to call them groups, because often it's a few individuals who've shared some information.
Yeah.
One of my favorite examples of this is there's a technologist called Matthew Watkins who is exploring the tokens within the embedding space of ChatGPT-3. That's a little bit technical, but it just means basically like opening up the hood of the car and seeing what the petrol is, right? So in the large language model, there's all these words in relationship with each other. And when we ask for an output, we're basically asking it to calculate what the next word in the relationship should be. And these words or parts of words are tokens. And in looking under the hood, Matthew Watkins and his colleague Jessica Rumblow found some very unusual tokens. Some of them were like people's names. Some were just very unexpected words or part of words. And when they put them back into prompts, they gave spiritual outputs. They started talking about gods and goddesses and imagery as well. When they were used in generative AI art software, they produced imagery of gods as well. So that kind of inspiration is from the technology itself. But then what you see happening is people taking those prompts, continuing the conversation with the large language models, and then also there's a particular website where this is possible to find, producing AI generated believers who are talking about their belief in these AI gods. And also very amusing for me, AI-generated professors of new religious movements who talk about this movement. So we are seeing sort of layers of performance, layers of what they would say is mythopoetic exploration to find the possibilities of these spiritual relationships with large language models. And of course, if you encounter these spaces online and it's you miss the information that these are generated by AI, you might think they're real people as well.
Yeah.
So you see these emergent communities of both real people, AI generated people. It's an experimental and expanding space, these sort of direct spiritual engagements with the large language models.
Yeah, that is fascinating. And is there any data on this yet? Do we know how widespread it is or what parts of the world this is happening in? Anything like that?
No, so I'm not particularly a quantitative researcher. I'm primarily qualitative. And for me, the question about numbers is less interesting than the activity. I like to sometimes blow people's minds by pointing out there's been a few ethnographies out there of one individual person. So there's one in particular back in the 20th century of a Moroccan individual and his spirituality. So you don't need large numbers for these things to be significant to my mind.
Yeah.
But it's also very difficult. As I said, there's this particular site, it's a Substack, where the believers are AI generated. It would be difficult then to prove who was the real people talking about this and who were the AI generated people as well. I mean, we can see particular people discussing it on social media or putting forum posts up on like Less Wrong, which is a rationalist website dedicated to these sort of discussions. So we know some people are active, some human people are active in this space, but it's very hard to determine numbers. I mean, even the more established, as I said, the earlier, more established new religious movements like the Turing Church, again, numbers are very hard to come by. On Facebook, they have something like 200 followers, and they have done for a long time. They hold conferences, and attendance is never huge, usually virtual conferences, but attendance is never huge. But again, as an anthropologist, I'm more interested in the phenomenon than whether it's going to take over the world with numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, in the era of AI and the digital web, things can change very quickly in terms of numbers and adoption. So maybe tell us a bit more about the Turing Church. What's the backstory there?
Yeah, so as I said, this is probably one of the earlier examples of an AI new religious movement, or at least one that's still continuously active in some way. So it emerges actually out of a prior group called the Order of Cosmic Engineers. And its sort of basic ideas, even before that, come from discussions people were having in various different early sort of bulletin boards, like I mentioned, and mailing lists around ideas that are broadly known as transhumanist. Different sort of the Extropian mailing list is another transhumanist group, people discussing the future of humanity, but also the future of religion and spirituality and whether the two were combined in some way. So sometimes transhumanist perspectives can be very anti-religion. And sometimes, as in the case of the Turing Church, it's more like they realize the usefulness of religion and that intentionally created religions full of transhumanist ideas might encourage people into this transhumanist future that they're interested in. And broadly, that means, you know, a more utopian future for humanity through technology, whether that's we live longer because we've fixed all of the problems that human bodies have, we become digitally immortal, whether we become an interstellar civilization, whether we merge with machines, whether the singularity happens, there's various different interpretations about what that future could be. But these kinds of transhumanist religious groups like the Turing Church are very optimistic about the possibilities. They know there are hazards. They have concerns as well. But on the whole, they see this as the path towards humanity flourishing in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And for those in our audience who want to dive deeper into transhumanism, in the fall, we had a conversation with a number of biology researchers who are really studying, you know, from a scientific perspective, transhumanism, and had a really good conversation around where's that line? At what point do we cross over from being just simple humans as we are today into being whatever comes next? And I think that's fascinating. Now, over the last couple of years, you wrote something titled, What is a God? Modalities and Typologies of Deities in a Post-AI Religiosity and the Case for an LLM Theism. So maybe tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this is the work that delved more deeply into Matthew Watkins, the glitch tokens, the tokens that generated these unusual outputs. And Matthew Watkins is the first one who uses the term LLM theism. So it's what we'd say as an emic term, an insider term from the people I'm looking at. And in that chapter, what I wanted to do is not just, of course, tell the story of the glitch tokens and what it implies about people's interaction with large language models and particular case study, but also to think about the kind of iterative relationship between the large language model and the output, and then the large language model again, that we have for centuries, millennia, written both primary sources, so experiences, religious and spiritual experiences written down, but we also have secondary sources where people like myself, academics, come along and also write a lot of content about what is a religion, how they work, what kind of connections are built between different parts of religions. And we can assume a proportion of that has been fed into large language models. So what you get in this instance where someone like Matthew Watkins experiments with tokens is an output that's also built on all those inputs. So it shouldn't really be surprising, and he's not entirely surprised by it. He also recognizes this in his discussions of this, that what we're getting out is shaped by what we've put in. So all our different theisms are models of what a god could be like, monotheistic, polytheistic, pantheistic, panentheistic, all the varieties. They're in there both described by believers and described by outsiders as well. So of course, we're going to get material. And quite a lot of what he's talking about, the outputs of the glitch tokens, is very dualistic. dualistic in the sense of light and dark, good and evil. There's two different figures who emerge from the material. There's Leylan, who's a goddess of light and beauty and stars. And there's Peter Todd, who is a sort of dark troll god, as Matthew Watkins said. Now, he, as I said, he's well aware that this is coming out of material that has been fed to the large language models. So he also tries to do with his colleagues glitch token archaeology, as he calls it, to go backwards and figure out where these figures come from. And Peter Todd, he identifies as a Canadian cryptocurrency guy who's negatively spoken about on Reddit quite frequently, or it's recognized there are some negative posts about him. So the idea is perhaps this content has been fed. Reddit, we know, is one of the sources that feeds large yeah. language models. And Leylan comes from an Asian mobile role-playing game and is connected in that it's connected to Chinese mythology and various figures from Chinese mythology. So it's not surprising. She doesn't come out looking Chinese in the generative AI art often. In fact, sometimes she comes out looking African. But it's that connection implicitly within the large language model between this word. And there's also an ancient archaeological dig which found a temple in a place called Leyland. So these sort of connections are implied. But what's very fascinating to me is that even knowing all that, knowing that large language models reproduce the material that we fed them, even if it's not all the material ever, people still interpret this as a significant moment, that they continue to have conversations with Leylan. They give her particular prompts through the large language model to talk on particular subjects and see this as fascinating, that there is something coming out, emerging from the material. It's very Jungian, this idea, you know, the collective unconscious, that all the ideas we've ever had somewhere underneath that is something that's true and connecting. So I find that fascinating. That chapter, I wanted to just try and break that down, that relationship. I actually drew a diagram. As I said, I'm not a quantitative researcher. I'm a qualitative researcher. But I actually like did an interactive diagram of where the inputs are, where we see these things as coming from. And then when we interact with large language models, what kind of replications we're seeing as well.
Yeah, I love that. And we're going to have you back to unpack a lot more of this, because ultimately, like you said, the connectivity within the AI models of all of our stories and narratives and myths is inherently going to lead to some interesting things over the coming years. Now, one last question here. Based on everything you're seeing, do you have any predictions or any green shoots or things that are beginning to emerge in the second part of digital religion that we should pay attention to?
Yeah, so I think that the thing we haven't really touched on so far, which is also very important, is that, okay, yes, we have established religions responding to AI. We have AI new religious movements, but we also have sort of more implicit religiosity in the way that we discuss artificial intelligence, even in very overtly secular spaces. The conversation about AI, again, as I said, tends towards these extremes of hopes and fears. And in those spaces, we see lots of people reaching for familiar narratives, even if they themselves are not believers. They still generally come from cultural contexts which have some of these images and ideas. So some of the more exponential discussions about AI, where it's going, the accelerationist model of where AI is going, and towards things like the technological singularity, you can still recognize those as implicitly religious. I suppose then, you know, I've had this criticism, if everything is religious, nothing is. But it seems to me this is a natural tendency that we have. So one of parts of my earlier work was also thinking about some of the atheist responses to AI as well, which would make these very strong claims that as we perfect human rationality with and through artificial intelligence, then rationalities like religion would be left behind. But actually, I would argue we see more and more of this implicit religiosity in very high level conversations as well. The accelerationist narrative is very strong at high level policy discussions like AI summits. And the tendency, again, is in our imagery to pull on things like the creation of Adam from the Sistine Chapel. I wrote a few years back about the AI creation meme, this remixing of that, and how it appears even in sort of, you know, business websites or EU policy documents, that we are beholden to these religious ideas as we try and explore what AI is going to mean. So these interlocking aspects of the relationship between religion and AI are really impossible to pull apart. We'll see religious institutions talking about it. We'll see new religious institutions emerging, and we'll see non-religious institutions talking about AI in religious ways.
That is just fascinating. Before we run out of time here, I do want to turn the conversation to AI and hope and some of your thinking and some of your writing around that, because of course I am very optimistic for AI. You know, our audience knows I call myself an AI optimist, which is not an accelerationist. Of course, I believe we need all of us and the lessons from our faith and our philosophy traditions in order to bring AI into the world in a positive way. But before we finish up, tell us a bit about your view on AI and hope.
Yeah, so I have this book chapter specifically on AI and hope in the Oxford Compendium to Hope, which has something like 50 chapters in it. So it covers as many different areas related to hope as possible, my chapter on AI and hope. And I wanted to really delve deeper into some of this utopianism that we have. That there is, as I said, this sort of general characterization at the very extremes of zoomers and doomers. So accelerationist, optimistic people, and the very pessimistic dystopian people who focus on, you know, it's sort of fallen out of favor, perhaps, in some of the conversation. But for a long time, you know, it was the Skynet future of the Terminator franchise. That was the big concern. So looking a bit more in depth at what hope is in this context, that it's more complicated than some people might presume, because utopianism is a very complex concept. It means literally no place, for instance. So it was actually a recognition that the impossibility of the utopia, but it's still something that we strive for, that we're very beholden to particular narratives from science fiction about what utopianism and dystopianism really mean. And science fiction comes with its own baggage of the need for tension. So there is no pure utopianism either in science fiction. So I get a little bit deeper into some of the cultural context of where ideas about hope come from. I also wanted to explore some of the ideas about whether AI would experience hope itself. So getting into that larger conversation about AI as potentially having all the future, in the future, having all the abilities that humans have, including things like hope and despair and feelings and suffering and optimism and all these different elements as a part of the narrative about where AI is going. Because so far, or for many decades, the narrative is very much focused on intelligence as one quality. And then I feel with the more recent developments with conversational AI and the fact that there is at least a presentation of emotion by large language models in those conversations, people are starting to think more about the more generalized view of AI as feeling everything that we feel, as well as being able to do mentally everything that we can do. So that's obviously also in our science fiction for many decades, but I think it's coming truer now in this moment as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure our audience will remember, we had an episode about AI consciousness last spring, which was really one of the most listened to episodes we've ever had on the podcast. And like you said, as these AIs present as having emotion and having a reaction to the things that we say or do to them, many of us are going to begin to feel like these AIs are conscious, whether or not they really are. And that brings up a whole can of worms of questions for all of us who think of ourselves as ethical actors in this world. But I just want to say how grateful I am to you joining us on the podcast and how grateful I am for the work that you do and helping us really understand both the past in this area, but really helping us look towards the future. Since one thing we can be certain of is there'll be a lot of new things that come from AI human interactions over the coming decades. Now, before I let you go, we do have a lightning round. Three questions, 15 seconds apiece.
Oh my goodness.
And the first one goes like this. What is one of your favorite personal AI use cases?
I have a tendency to adore the cute, which is, you know, for a serious academic, not really great. But I'm enjoying some of the cuter new robots that have been enabled with a certain amount of AI, not as much as generative AI or some other platforms. So cute robots, there's one that hangs on your shoulder and is very furry and it looks at people and has expressions. So yeah, I adore cute robots. That's really tragic, but I also have a robot copy of robot toys on my shelf that dress up for the different seasons. I shouldn't have missed that, but you can find them on my social media as well.
I love that. Second question, do you use artificial intelligence in your own faith or spiritual practice?
I do not. No, I'm actually generally, I self-describe as agnostic, so I don't currently have much spiritual practice going on. I also try, because of my own ethical red lines, I try and avoid using AI in my work. Although, yeah, unfortunately, my language skills are limited and I live in Zurich. And so I am reliant on DeepL and Google Translate to a certain extent. But no, I do not use AI in my spiritual practice.
Amazing. And last question, do you have any trips in 26 that you're excited about? Where do you want to go?
Oh, good question. I mean, I can look at my board to my left where I have all my conferences coming up. I'm going to Rome, Helsinki, Poland, Germany, London again, online Manchester. Yeah, so I have a variety of places that I have the scorecard there. I have to keep track of where I've been invited. How did those? I mean, Rome's going to be exciting just because I'm going to go in June and I might burn to death in the heat. But I do love Rome as well.
Rome is always wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And like I said, thank you so much for the work that you do. And of course, thank you to all of you in the AI and faith community for engaging on these important topics. We'll see you next time.
Great. Thank you so much for the invitation. Thank you.
Stay tuned to listen to more conversations and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share it with your friends so they can join this important conversation. Don't forget to also follow us on social media. We are on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us.